This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Cincinnati Reds extend their losing streak and haven't won since opening day. The baseball season looks to be shaping up as another in a long line of disappointments for Cincinnati sports fans. But there is one local professional team that consistently achieves. The Cincinnati Cyclones are headed to another round of hockey playoffs. What's their secret? That's coming up. But first,
the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me.
I lift my lamp beside the golden door.
The U.S.-Mexico border represents the new Ellis Island for America. It is. It is because the aspirations of these immigrants coming through this border, it is the same aspirations and hopes that people had in New York back 100 years ago when they came to Ellis Island fleeing persecution, poverty. Isn't Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty created the ideal of America?
The University of Dayton Human Rights Center unveils a new exhibit this week, America, the Borderland, created by the Moral Courage Project and designed to shine a light on human rights defenders at the U.S.-Mexico border. Let's discuss how the project was created. Joining Cincinnati Edition today are Human Rights Center Executive Director Sherry Inglis. Welcome, Shelley.
Welcome. Thanks.
Assistant Professor of Human Rights and Coordinator of UD's Moral Courage Project, Joel Pruce. Welcome, Joel.
Thank you for having us.
And third-year political science major at Dayton, Rachel Carr. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi, thank you for having me.
If you have questions or comments for us as the program proceeds, give us a call, 513-419-7100. You can also email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets. Joel, tell us about what motivated this project. How did it start?
Sure. So America the Borderland, which is our new project, our new multimedia, multi-platform project, was really the second Moral Courage project. The whole program began in 2015, and in 2016, we took our first team of undergraduate students to a site of domestic human rights crisis, and in which case it was Ferguson. So in 2016, we trained, prepared students to do fieldwork in Ferguson, Missouri, and from those interviews, we produced a podcast, an exhibit, and a website. And so fast forward, we've recruited a new team, go to a new site. This time we're in El Paso, Texas, the U.S.-Mexico border. And we are now on the verge of launching a new series of work called America the Borderland, a podcast, an exhibit, a website, and a magazine.
So what was the work like? How many people were involved? What did you do while you were where you went?
Yeah. So the students applied and through a competitive process were selected, and we got undergraduate students from a range of majors, political science, human rights studies, international studies, communication, English, photography, and art. And we prepared them through a semester of work doing interviews and the ethics of interviewing, learning about the border and politics and storytelling and documentary work. And then we spent 2 weeks on the border. We conducted 50 interviews with organizers, activists, et cetera, community members, faith leaders. And with those interviews, we've been working since then to produce, to transcribe, and to conceptualize. And, we're really looking forward to sharing everything with the world.
So what type of student were you looking for as you went through that process?
You know, some students, like Rachel, had a background in podcasting or audio or interviewing, or at least an interest. But and other students had a background in writing, for instance, or photography. But others maybe were drawn by the subject matter to sort of focus on immigration and threats to immigrant rights. But aside from that, we're looking for tough kids. Kids that were going to be thrown into an unfamiliar and uncertain environment for an extended period of time. 2 weeks is a long time to be somewhere new, and prepare them to sort of to get through it and get through it and produce with a kind of strength that I don't think everyone has.
Rachel, are you a tough kid?
I'm tougher now.
Well, tell us about why you wanted to be a part of this.
I was really interested in the opportunity to record interviews and go to a new place and just be given the freedom to say, hi, I'm curious in where you live. I'm curious about who you are and your life. And that's a really unique privilege to be able to just go into a new place and ask those questions. So I was excited by the technical podcast aspect and then just interested by the opportunity to go into a new place with that opportunity.
You say you're tougher now. Why?
Well, like Dr. Pruce said, you just need to go into this space and be comfortable with being uncomfortable. And I think what made me tougher was just getting comfortable with going up to people I didn't know and asking those like personal questions and asking how they work with where they are. Yeah.
How many students were involved in this?
We were 14 students all told.
Okay, so how did you divide up the responsibilities and what type of work was being conducted?
Rachel?
Well, we were on the ground. We were split into pairs. So we'd go to interviews with a partner, and one person would be recording and holding the microphone and have the headphones on. And then the other person would be leading the interview and asking the questions. Each of those pairs had a theme. So I was focused on one particular organization, and that was the Border Network for Human Rights. And then once we were back home, the teams kind of switched and we focused on different types of productions. So I'm on the podcast team, and then we have a website team and a zine team.
And the exhibit we worked on together.
Yes. So
Rachel, what did you learn while you were there that maybe you didn't know about before?
I think there were so many shocking things beyond the technical skills and just the comfort that I developed with interviewing and talking to new people. I learned a lot about what our country does in the border. So the fact that we deport veterans, I wasn't aware about before we went. And so I learned—
Veterans from the U.S. military.
Yeah. So individuals who served in Vietnam and were drafted have been deported if they weren't citizens before and committed crimes. And that was just a shocking story. So I think there were a lot of instances where I thought I knew why people were deported, or I thought I knew why we didn't let people in, but there were so many more complicated instances.
Shelley, you're the director of the Human Rights Center at the University of Dayton. Is the situation at the U.S.-Mexico border a human rights issue?
Oh, yes, for sure.
Explain to us how.
Well, just to say that this launch of America at the Borderland is part of a series of events we're doing at UD and providing a human rights award, which we call the Romero Human Rights Award, to human rights defenders in El Salvador who are working on accountability and investigations to bring to justice those who committed wide-scale human rights abuses in El Salvador during the Civil War. And they continue to work on violence, high level of violence that exists in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, and to try and address this issue of violence, which is pervasive in the Northern Triangle. That is one of the major push factors, as you know, for why people move and why people are coming to the United States is because of the high level of violence. Of course, there are other economic issues that are driving people to the border. And these people who have claims that if they return, they could be subject to further violence, have a right to what we call asylum, to seek asylum, a right to have their cases heard, and to a right to have a judge determine whether they should be able to be provided refuge in this country. And we have not been able to develop a system that is at this point capable of providing those people who are seeking refuge in the United States the kind of due process, the kind of time and effort that we need to look at their cases and make sure we're not returning people back to situations where they could be subject to extreme violence. So we're looking at this whole system around the kind of violence that is in the Northern Triangle, how it pushes people to seek refuge, and then how we are responding on the border in the United States, which frankly, you know, there's a lot of contemporary discussion about the choices that we're making in the United States and whether these choices are the right ones for building a society that is at peace and can, you know, provide people justice.
Is there any concern that U.S. government policy is violating human rights along the border?
Yes, the United States, both internationally under international law and through our domestic law, has the legal responsibility to provide people due process to be able to hear their claims and to be able to determine whether their claims for refuge are valid. And that is critical to protection that we have provided to people, not just from Central America, but throughout the world. There is a history on our southern border, however, of not doing that very well. So while we've been able to provide through Ellis Island and through other processes, people with just processes of determining migration and refugee status in on our southern border, we have failed over time to develop the right kind of system and policy that can manage the drivers of people to the United States. So America the Borderland uses this Ellis Island discussion to be able to highlight what is happening on the border and the need to be able to treat the border in a way that is in line with international human rights law and in line with our basic values and principles.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation or ask questions of this team that went down to the border and came back to produce an exhibit for the Human Rights Center in Dayton. So U.S. policy at the Mexican border has, of course, dominated headlines for a long time, but particularly since President Donald Trump took office, building a wall along the border was a huge campaign piece of his campaign platform. A new headline emerged late Sunday evening into today after Homeland Security Secretary Kirsten Gillibrand resigned. So what did you find, Joel and Rachel, at the border in your work that we don't necessarily see in the national news reporting?
Yeah, well, I would say at least a couple things. I mean, on the one hand, there's an organization and a physical building called Annunciation House that's in El Paso. It's run by a man named Ruben Garcia, who has increasingly been interviewed in mainstream press, but before recently was relatively anonymous. He runs a shelter. He runs a refuge for people facing deportation one way or the other, or facing resettlement within the country. And he recently has been inundated, but, you know, hundreds and thousands of beds he needs to provide because we don't have, like Shelley suggested, we don't have the systems for dealing with these people, even in the remotely, you know, humane ways. And so hearing about his work was really very moving. And I think what's most important, a very important takeaway for me was to understand that there is an urgency to the crisis now, the manufactured crisis that is being driven by U.S. policy. But this is also 25 years or more in the making. And so a lot of the folks we talked to down there have been, you know, cutting their teeth and building movements and building organizations and systems to create a humane, you know, city and a safe city for a place that is, you know, 99% Hispanic.
What do you mean by manufactured crisis?
Well, you know, the way that we have not only failed to deal with an influx of particularly families and children who are here seeking refuge, but the buildup of the militarized buildup on the border, all the rhetoric that is terribly xenophobic and racist around the wall and separation, those are all of our making. Those are choices that the administration has made to respond to immigration. Again, immigration is a very natural process. People move. People have always moved. How we decide to respond to that movement are a set of choices that we've made, and least of which with, you know, the Secretary of Homeland Security resigning in the last, you know, 24, 48 hours, she oversaw a system of family separation where children and their parents were physically and maybe forever separated because they're not even being tracked. These things are of our own doing.
So you can cite those issues, and some have, as being violations of human rights, separating the families. We've heard of cages being involved in some of these scenarios. And now the secretary has resigned with some speculation that perhaps she wasn't tough enough for the president's policy. So when you're looking at the results of the policies that have been implemented on the border, are you concerned that it's going to get worse down there?
Oh, I think that it could very well get worse. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's not really clear if the policies have caught up to the rhetoric that are being used, which is why it's so important. That's why our exhibit really emphasizes the ordinary people who have been working on the border for dozens of years to try to create humane conditions and build movements, you know, around human dignity. And by centering their voices, cut out some of the more polarizing and hate-filled and extreme language and really focus on what people are doing to inspire other people across the country, because these are issues that are not just at the border, right? ICE is in, you know, Hamilton County right here and in cities and counties across the country. And so we as Americans, as people living in our communities, can learn from people on the border on how to respond to these times.
And Rachel, what about you? What did you witness there that you think we're missing in the nightly news reports?
I think I was surprised by how we were welcomed. And this is a city that the central question is, how do we welcome people at our borders? So just to get the experience of being welcomed into the city and into these organizations was really not what I would have expected had I just been watching the news. You see a very militarized city, but you also experience a lot of hospitality. Watching the organizers in this town share their stories and their experiences was a really surprising perspective, because I had experienced stories of the border as current stories, but I had never heard the decades-long practice of defending a home and defending a community on the border.
513-419-7100 is the number to call to join the conversation. We will continue this discussion about the new exhibit showcasing defenders of human rights at the U.S.-Mexico border just ahead. Plus, we'll look at the Cincinnati Cyclones as they head for another cup playoff and talk about local recreational hockey programs in our region. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. What is life like at the U.S.-Mexico border for defenders of human rights? That's the focus of a new exhibit opening this week at the University of Dayton's Human Rights Center. We continue now with Human Rights Center Executive Director Shelley Inglis, Assistant Professor of Human Rights and Coordinator of UD's Moral Courage Project, Joel Proust, and third-year political science major at Dayton, Rachel Carr. 513-419-7100 is the number to call to join the conversation. You can also email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. I should correct something I said earlier when I said Secretary of Homeland Security Kirsten Gillibrand resigned. She's, of course, a senator from New York. I meant Kirstjen Nielsen, who resigned as Secretary of Homeland Security. You're nodding your head like you knew this, Shelley, and you didn't correct me. You could have saved me some grief that we're now getting from listeners. So I'll keep my eye on you moving forward. But let me talk to you briefly, Shelley. America the Borderland, that's the name of this project that's on display. It's part of the Human Rights Center's Moral Courage Project. What is meant by the name, moral courage, as it relates to this project?
It talks about people who stand up in their society, who are on the front lines of human rights defending. Basically, it's about people who show moral courage in the face of difficulties, hardship, in the face of struggles, that they do not just stand by and watch their societies disintegrate, but they stand up, they take action, they organize at the community level, and they're about solving problems. And that's what this project is about, raising the voices of those who are upstanders who often don't get their voices heard in the national or even in local discussions. So our moral courage is about teaching students to understand and document and to be able to reflect out the experiences of those who on a day-to-day basis are defending human rights.
And previously you featured a work that Joel referenced earlier. It was called Ferguson Voices Disrupting the Frame. And that's a reference to some of the unrest that we dealt with in Ferguson, Missouri a few years ago. What role is this center finding for itself by exploring these important national topics in this way?
I think it's finding a way to really educate and provide students an opportunity to understand what it means to practice human rights in a really realistic way. It is not just about global international norms or high-level policy discussions that people have in Washington or at major international organizations. It's about training students about how in everyday life there is a human rights responsibility and that we can practice that on a daily basis. Our center is really focused on what does advocacy mean? What does activism mean in the world of human rights? How do you practice and make human rights a part of daily life? And it's something in the United States where we've also often looked at human rights for others in other countries, in developing countries, in places that have less opportunities or economic growth than we do. It's a really important time that students learn that human rights start at home.
We got a comment from listener Mark. He says, we're talking about this as if it's a U.S. problem, but isn't it the problem of other countries? How can we take care of everyone who wants to come here? Shouldn't immigration be controlled? I can open that up to the panel here if you'd like to weigh in on that perspective from Mark.
I mean, like Shelley said earlier, there are push and pull factors. And so on the one hand, we as a country have always prided ourselves, such as it says on the Statue of Liberty, to be a refuge for people seeking opportunity and safety. And so we either stand for that or we don't, no matter who is causing the problem. However, it also so happens that there are many problems throughout the region that have that are, you know, that have originated here, whether it has to do with, you know, agricultural subsidies that benefit American farmers over Mexican farmers, or political violence in El Salvador that started in American prisons. I mean, so understanding our regional responsibility, I think, is central to understanding what's going on.
We got a question from Carl, who is basically asking whether you can compare what he cites as racism now in the discussion about immigration at the border and compare that to some of our historic immigration trends and the discrimination that encountered some of those folks, whether they were coming from Ireland or Italy or from wherever. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, we can say that definitely there's a history in the United States of, at certain moments, focusing in on specific groups who are new in the United States and generating a lot of racism or antipathy, exclusion of these groups. Of course, what we also find in the United States is many of these groups are the drivers of new innovation. They're the drivers of new forms of employment. They're a integral part of making the United States the dynamic and interesting and wealthy, frankly, country that it is. So there is always this need to really look at whether those who are using exclusionary and racist terminology are doing it for another purpose, and what is the reason behind excluding others within a society that fundamentally needs the labor, needs the mindsets, needs the innovation, and needs the cultural diversity to be able to grow and change. I'd like to just say one thing about the interconnectedness of these issues. I think absolutely it is true that at this point, migration, climate change, any issue you can talk about is not just for the United States to determine itself. It isn't a country in a vacuum, and of course shares borders, and it also shares a lot of interests with other countries. Many of these issues can be discussed and should be discussed with other countries to determine the best way forward collaboratively and together. And I just want to emphasize that while we're focusing in on the United States, a lot of our work also looks at human rights issues in other countries. And that's why we're bringing our awardees, who are human rights defenders from El Salvador, who, again, on a daily basis, are working towards justice and accountability for prior violence in El Salvador. When we look at justice and accountability, we're looking at ways of coming to terms with the challenges that countries face. And of course, in the United States, we have a legacy of, for example, slavery that we need to come to terms with. In El Salvador, we have a legacy of the Civil War that they're coming to terms with. But all countries go through these processes, and human rights defending sort of transcends borders and transcends countries.
So, Joel, now all of your work is complete with your students who went to the border. What type of exhibit is this? What are we going to see physically when we come to this?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, we've selected about 10 or 12 people of the 50 that we've interviewed to feature in the exhibit. And the exhibit features their interviews, so text from their interviews, as well as portraits and photography from the landscape to really give you a sense of what it's like in El Paso. And we've selected different personalities, you know, in an effort around different themes to give you different slices of life. So you'll hear from educators, you'll hear from faith leaders, you'll hear from lawyers, you'll hear from, you know, community organizers, students, undocumented, queer people, you know, the full gamut of the texture of what life is like in El Paso.
So the University of Dayton is a Catholic institution. And I wonder how the Catholic faith plays a role in this project.
Sure. I mean, you know, I'm not Catholic myself, but having spent a lot of time with the interviews, particularly of a man named Monsignor Arturo Bonuelas, who runs a parish in El Paso, you know, he speaks very profoundly about how the call to Christ is the call to be in solidarity with the poor and the immigrant. And that is as clear to him as anything. And, you know, he says to be a good Catholic, you don't just go and pray, you serve. And what that means is you come, you sit with people, you hear their story, and you dismantle the barriers that separate us. I mean, he talks about, in Spanish, he says, tú eres mi otro yo. So you are my other self. Like, thinking about solidarity in like a very, very profound way for him is very much driven by his faith.
And these are countries in Latin America that are predominantly Catholic. So what role does the Catholic faith play in immigration policy nationally? Is there a better place for it?
Yeah, I mean,
the message that you just shared about the religion's role in the conversation makes it sound like, you know, we're not necessarily doing enough.
Well, I think the Pope Francis has been very clear on the position of the Catholic Church in relation to migrants and refugee seeking. There is a lot of work that is going on within Catholic churches in the United States and outside of the United States around the rights of migrants and the rights of refugees. And this is not a position that the church has not spoken out on. The church is very clear about its position around migrants and refugees. We also have coming Ashley Feasley to University of Dayton on the day that we are launching American the Borderland, and she is the policy officer for the United States Catholic bishops. And she will be talking about the proactive role that the church is taking around the rights of migrants and asylum seekers. There is no question that the University of Dayton, we call ourselves the University for the Common Good, we believe that those who seek refuge and those who want to migrate for opportunity have absolutely the right to do so. And that is in line with the history that the church has long taken on these issues.
The name of the exhibit is America, the Borderland. When does it open?
It opens Thursday. And I should add that it's sort of multimedia, multi-platform work. So there's a podcast by the same name that the trailer for which is available on your podcast app and iTunes and Spotify. And the first episode is Friday. AmericaTheBorderland.org will also be live by Thursday, Friday. And the exhibit hopefully will have a long life after it opens at UD and is available for hosting.
We'll put those details at WVXU.org. I want to thank Human Rights Center Executive Director Shelley Inglis, Assistant Professor of Human Rights and Coordinator of UD's Moral Courage Project, Joel Proust, and third-year political science major at Dayton, Rachel Carr, for joining us today. Thanks to all of you for coming down. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. I'm Michael Monks. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org.